From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Michael Krasny. Coming up, she's the daughter of farm workers, a judge who rose quickly through the legal and political ranks in Sacramento. And now, Tani Cantil Sakaue is the 28th Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court. She took over in January, and she joins us this hour to talk about her judicial philosophy, how budget cuts threaten the state's courts, the value of having diversity on the bench, and the status of Proposition 8, the same-sex marriage ban that's back in her court. And of course, you're welcome to join the conversation. We'll get started with Forum right after this. Good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in this week for Michael Krasny. Well, when Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger named his choice to replace retiring Chief Justice Ronald George, it surprised a lot of people. Tani Cantil Sakaue is the daughter of farm workers, a product of California's public schools, a former casino card dealer, and now the most powerful judge in the state. And she's with us here in the studio to talk about her priorities and some of the challenges facing the courts. Chief, thanks for coming in.
Good morning, Scott. Thank you for having me.
Well, you've been on the job just about 3 months, not quite. How's it going?
It's very exciting. It's always challenging, and there's never a dull moment.
Well, and you got off, speaking of no dull moments, you were sworn in the 3rd of January, and then I believe it was the very next day the Court of Appeals kicked a question down or over to the state Supreme Court on Proposition 8. And then I think a day or two after that, one of the justices announced he was retiring, Carlos Moreno. There's a lot going on at one for the first week on the job, wasn't there? How do you deal with all that change?
Well, that's exactly right. In fact, those two things happened on the same day. Justice Moreno came into chambers and announced that he was leaving the court the morning of January 4th. And then later that afternoon, we received the question asking for the standing issue from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And so because I have had no other experience on the Supreme Court, it sort of seems all in a day's work. However, I think there was quite consternation in the branch itself to hear that Carlos was leaving. And also the Ninth Circuit question brought the entire Supreme Court. It just started the buzz all over again.
And I want to come back to both of those two things. But, you know, this may be the very first time our listeners are hearing from you. And I want to sort of explore a little bit about you and how you came to this point. Now, when you were appointed by governor, you had been on the bench 20 years. You were appointed to the municipal court in Sacramento by Governor Duke Majan, for whom you worked as a deputy legislative affairs director, I believe, or
yes.
Legal affairs director.
Legal affairs and then in ledge affairs.
And then Governor Schwarzenegger elevated you to the appeals court in Sacramento.
Yes.
So you had 20 years experience, and yet it seemed like for many people who even pay attention to the courts that your nomination came a bit out of the blue. How surprised were you when you found out that you were being considered for this job?
I was quite surprised. I had not considered myself a candidate. First of all, the chief's retirement was a complete surprise. I had served on judicial counsel with the chief for approximately 2 years to that point, and I always marveled at his ability and his energy to multitask and to address the most important issues of the state. So mind you, it never occurred to me that he would step down. So when he stepped down, I was just amazed, shocked, and I joke that after I picked myself up off the floor and dried my tears, I very soon thereafter received a call from the governor's office. And I remember telling my husband at the time that the chief announced his retirement, I said, "This is going to be good theater." And I meant that in every best sense of the word, because having served on council now for some period of time and having worked on statewide committees, I knew a number of incredibly worthy candidates who I always thought would go to the Supreme Court. And so I waited to see who would be named, like everyone else. And then to get the call myself was not part of my equation of good theater.
Was it really? It was truly just out of the blue, no idea, no inkling?
Absolutely. Out of the blue, no inkling. It came in, the call came in on a Thursday, and it came into my private line, which friends and family call on. And so I didn't expect when I picked up the line that the governor's office would be on the other end inquiring if I was interested in the position and then setting up an interview. It came very quickly. I think I had a series of calls on the Thursday after the chief announced that asked me if I was interested, would I put in a letter, and would I come for an interview, and could it be the next Monday? It moved very quickly. And at the time, my only thought was, like the Oscars, it's an honor to be nominated, and I will certainly take all of these interviews. But I even then didn't think that I would be named.
When the news came out, you know, those of us in radio, we can't just get the spelling right. We have to get the pronunciation right. Mm-hmm. And I looked at the AP story and we said, how do we pronounce her name? And I called the Judicial Council. They gave me a pronunciation. I called your chambers. They gave me a different pronunciation. We went with that pronunciation. But you're Filipina American. Tell us a little bit about your family, your background. I know your parents, as I said at the top, were farm workers. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, I come from a large Filipino family that has been farming for quite a period of time. They started in Hawaii. They came from the Philippines to work in Hawaii and work the fields in Hawaii and then eventually came to California. Those are my grandparents. And they had children along the way in Hawaii and along the Delta towns of California where the crops were. And my mother grew up along those lines. My father grew up in Hawaii along similar lines. And so I grew up in a family that always talked about hard work and always talked about the fields and always talked about the camps and always talked about the importance of family. But at the same time, a very traditional Filipino family of respect for your elders, authority for your elders, respect for just the institution of family and church. And so I was the youngest daughter of a family of four. And so I grew up, quite honestly, just being very respectful, listening closely amongst my elders. Now, being the child, the fourth of four, two brothers and a sister, in order to assert my right in the family, I had to do a fair amount of talking, a fair amount of bravado, a fair amount of struggle and challenge because you have two brothers and a sister. And if you want a bowl of ice cream, you need to assert yourself.
Right. So who was it? How did you get the idea to go to law school?
I got the idea when I was in a junior college and I joined a speech and debate team. And the coaches there and people I met along the way as I competed encouraged me. But my first, I think, thought about ever becoming a lawyer came when my mother took me to see the first Filipino lawyer that our community had ever seen or heard of. And that is my good friend now, Gloria Ochoa. And my mother took me to a Filipino function. We went to a lot of functions, but I remember this one particularly because my mother actually paid special attention to me and sat me down to listen to Gloria. And then she told me, you know, you can do this. I didn't know what this was. I just know that my mother, who hardly took that much attention for me, sat me down. This was important. It was the way my mother saw and treated Gloria that my mother related to me that gave me the impression that a Filipino lawyer, this is something unusual and really good, whatever that might be.
Almost every article and every news story about you when you were first nominated began by mentioning that you would be the first Filipina American on the court. And I wonder how you feel about that part of your biography being elevated to the first or second sentence.
Well, I am certainly proud of my ancestral family and my culture. I will balance that by saying that I have been, as you alluded to, a judge for 20 years, and before that, a lawyer for a period of years. And in those 26 years, I have come to not think of myself as female or as Filipina. I just consider myself like any other legal professional who comes to work. And so after 26 years, I've sort of lost my sort of sense of self-consciousness about those parts of my personality and profile. So when I was appointed into this position and I assessed my profiles, I thought, I haven't been described as the first Filipina in a long time. When I initially got to the bench in 1990-91, that was a big issue. But I haven't really been aware of that consciously in the print for the last 20 years as I've done my work. So
it was almost reminding you of the fact that it was a big deal.
Yes. And I am so proud of my Filipino history and my family that I consider it a wonderful attribute. It's a great personal strength for me, one that I rely on in times of challenge. But I tell you, it is not the first way I think about myself now after so many years on the bench.
Talking with the Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court, Tani Cantil Sacaue. each year, the Judicial Council puts out a report by state law, the demographics of the courts and what the judges, the 1,700 or so judges throughout the state, what their demographics are. And that report for this year came out at the end of February. And I'm sure you know some of the details, but roughly 72% of the judges in California, and then we're talking now about the trial courts, the appellate courts, and the state Supreme Court, are white males. You're not. Did you represent – well, how important do you think it is to diversify the bench? How important is it and why is it important to have a judiciary that looks more like the state?
It's incredibly important that the judicial branch reflect the state's population. And that's because the judicial branch as a third co-equal branch of government is a place of a location, a situation where – the branch upholds the Constitution and the statutory and case law of the state. And so it is a place where conflict is resolved. And so where conflict is resolved, where people come to resolve conflict, it's important that the branch reflect the population so that the population has faith that those people who are in a position to resolve conflict understand them, appreciate them, and that they believe that they are in a place where they are, where litigants come to know that they are represented as well. It's an inclusive, important factor. And I think, based on my years in the branch, that diversity adds a different kind of conversation. We have a different kind of conversation when we discuss an issue, when you have people from different racial or gender, ethnic origin at the table, because we bring different interpretations, and that's what we do. And that's really important when we interpret the law, when we enforce the law for the population of California.
Can you give an example of the kind of issue or the kind of conversation that might be different?
Well, I think some of it has to do – I think this has been mentioned before, but in, for example, certain Asian cultures, it is respectful not to look a person in the eye when you are answering a question or refuting information. It's in American culture, it is considered looking directly into your eyes to be a trait of honesty and integrity and strength. But that is not necessarily transferable to an Asian community. And also, I would
So a judge seeing that might think, well, they have something to hide if they're not looking at the attorney in the eye or whatever it might be.
That's right. So if there is a determination to be made on credibility and a judge is a fact finder on that, it's important for the judge to know that there are cultural differences that influence how a person may answer a question and it doesn't bear on the veracity. Another thing I would say is sometimes – certain cultures are not willing to necessarily report immediately to the police or to law enforcement issues in the community. That doesn't mean necessarily what some might believe, that maybe those communities don't trust the law enforcement or are not forthcoming because there may be something to hide, but because in that country there were concerns about going to law enforcement. And those kinds of beliefs may be handed down inadvertently to later generations. And that affects, I think, reporting and how a judge as a fact finder might think about a case.
There are seven members of the California Supreme Court. One of those seats is now vacant. Carlos Moreno stepped down at the end of February. There is no African-American member. There is now no Latino member of the court. I know you met with Governor Brown a few weeks ago and talked with him about a number of things, mostly, I think, the budget. But what can you tell us a little bit about what you discussed about the kind of person that you'd like to see him choose to replace Carlos Moreno?
Well, we spent little time on that issue, given the issue of the budget, and that was our first meeting. But I hope that the governor, and I have full faith that this governor will appoint the most qualified person. And as you point out, we are missing, in terms of representation on the California Supreme Court, an African-American or a Latino. And I know that I look forward to the diversity on the branch, and I encourage the governor to make the most qualified, diverse appointment that he sees fit to make. I also am aware that in making that kind of appointment, that it's important that the state also reflect, the Supreme Court also reflect the state's geographical diversity. That's important because we are the state Supreme Court and there are only seven of us. So I hope and believe and have every faith that this governor will appoint the most qualified, diverse candidate that he can find.
And in terms of geography, Carlos Moreno was from Los Angeles. Is there now really no one from the South?
Not recently. I understand certain of our justices may have been from the southern part of the state, but because San Francisco is the base primarily, most of the judges now are from the Bay Area or Northern California, like myself.
We're talking with the Chief Justice of California's Supreme Court, Tani Cantil Sacaue. And if you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call. The number is 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email your thoughts to forum@kqed.org. I want to ask you about Proposition 8. Before you joined the court, it's had a long legal history already, just the issue of same-sex marriage and now Proposition 8 in the state. Initially in 2008, the California Supreme Court allowed gay marriage to happen legally. Then the voters passed Proposition 8 later that year in November, banning same-sex marriage. There's now a lawsuit in the federal courts challenging Proposition 8. A lower court judge, Vaughn Walker, struck it down, but the appeals court is taking up the appeal from the proponents. Now, a question has been bumped over to your court by the appeals court, which you have accepted. You have said you will answer. Tell us what the question is that your court has now agreed to answer and what relevance it has to this question of same-sex marriage.
Well, it's important to note that this question is a procedural question about standing. And standing is a matter that has to be determined in every case across the state. So the question that was sent to us by the Ninth Circuit is whether the official proponents of an initiative measure, Proposition 8, whether or not they possess either a particularized interest in the measure's validity or can assert the state's authority in the validity of the measure, such that these proponents of Proposition 8 can defend Proposition 8, its constitutionality upon being adopted, or appeal a judgment invalidating Proposition 8 when the public officials have declined to do so.
And that's the case here.
That's right.
Governor Brown, former Governor Schwarzenegger, Jerry Brown when he was the Attorney General, and the current Attorney General, all refusing to defend it. And so that's the question, is whether state law allows for the proponents to defend a ballot measure that
right.
they have sponsored.
And these are the official proponents of Proposition 8, whether or not they have the standing to defend its validity on appeal.
And why is it important, do you think, for the California Supreme Court to weigh in? This is a federal court, the appeals court.
That's correct. This is, however, standing is a question of state law in terms of this California initiative measure. And that's why the question has been sent to us.
How surprised were you? Of course, again, it was day two on the job. How surprised were you that this hot potato was back in your court?
Not too surprised, simply because during the summer, that question percolated in the media, whether or not there would be a standing issue and whether or not that could come back to the California Supreme Court. So, however, I was somewhat surprised to receive it on my second day there.
Yeah. And there's been some question about the timeline. The opponents of Proposition 8 asked to expedite this so that this could be resolved more quickly. Their claim that every day that same-sex couples aren't allowed to get married is an injustice that they suffer. And the court declined to expedite that timeline. Tell us what the timeline is now and why the court decided not to expedite it.
Well, I think there's a little bit of a misunderstanding and it needs to be clarified. The court granted review of this question on February 16. And at that time when we granted review, on our own, without being asked, we expedited the briefing schedule. And we set that out in our February 16 order, this expedited briefing schedule that would set the schedule in such a way that if it's possible, we would be able to have potentially oral argument on this case in September. Now, that's unprecedented. we have never expedited a case in such a way to have it heard so quickly. And we did that on our own motion, and we signed that off on February 16. That order went out. February 17, a day after we had decided this matter and sent out the expedited schedule, we received a request to expedite this matter further. And we declined because we have already expedited it. We have already taken an unprecedented step in having this heard as soon as we can. And this is an important question, and we want to address it with deliberate and careful thought and calculation. And so this expedited schedule that we created permits us the opportunity to do that and still take into account the need to answer this question as promptly as we can.
There's a lot of speculation about judges and how judges look at questions, especially questions that have a political cast to them, whether it's abortion or gun control or campaign finance or, in this case, same-sex marriage. To what extent do a judge's personal points of view come into play, either consciously or unconsciously? Do you think when you're dealing with issues that are not just sort of mundane or nitty gritty legal questions, but big social questions?
I believe that in my 20 years, I have not ever seen a judge be influenced by his or her personal beliefs on the matter. Now, I think perhaps there might be an evolution of a judge so that one who's a new and experienced judge is going to face those questions for the first time, and that in facing those questions for the first time is going to have to hearken back to his or her oath and remember that you are making these decisions on these issues, regardless of how political they are, based on the Constitution and the rule of law. And over time, as you begin to refocus where you're tethered in making your decisions, that becomes easier and easier and easier. And that so those political considerations, while they might be very interesting off-table, off-conference discussions and academic discussions, they do not enter into the court's calculus of how an issue is decided because we are guided by so clearly the rule of law and the Constitution.
And yet judges can look at the rule of law and the facts in a case and come to a different conclusion. So what is it that tips the scale one way or the other? I mean, the same-sex marriage case back in 2008 was a 4-3 decision. So what is, if it's not personal interpretation or points of view, then what is it exactly?
Well, I think it really is grounded in interpretation of the rule of law. What does this law say? What does it mean? And that's where you'll have, of course, a natural disagreement. But I don't believe that that is influenced by a person's political, beliefs or philosophy. I think at some point, I've been a judge now for 20 years, and I know judges with many different years' experience. And, you know, we're not a particularly political group. Our focus is really narrow. And our world of the judicial branch, when we talk about cases and resolution of cases, is about the law and precedent and historical development. It's not about what's happening in the political world.
Tani Kantil Sakaue is our guest this hour on Forum. She's the new Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court. We'd love to hear from you this hour. Give us a call at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us. It's forum@kqed.org. And I'm Scott Schaefer, here this week for Michael Krasny. Stay with us. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here today for Michael Krasny. And our guest this hour is the Chief Justice of California's Supreme Court, Tani Kantil Sakaue. If you'd like to join us, the number again, 866-733-6786. Let's go to Sebastopol and Catherine. Good morning. Welcome.
Hello. Tani Kantil Sakaue, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Hi. I'm a science teacher out here in farm country in Sonoma County, Sebastopol. And I come across every day the idea from many of my students that they are not capable as girls to do the work as well as the boys. I really appreciated your comments on how you approach your job as a logical way of going about it as opposed to political. And I'm wondering, what do you do for young women to inspire them to be able to understand that they can achieve what anyone will achieve with hard work?
Thank you. That's a great question. And I have two daughters, and I tell them, and I believe, and I speak to groups whenever I can, especially women of all ages, especially young girls, that you can do anything, because once you have the tools that you get in school of reading and writing, that you can do anything if you put your mind to it. And that when you are self-conscious about being the only female, the only Asian, the only Asian female at the table, in the meeting, on the project, on the conference call, that you really have to remind yourself that only you are this self-conscious. And so if you can get over yourself and your own self-consciousness and just sort of put that to the side and just be who you are and feel free to be who you are, in time, people will get used to you being the only woman, the only girl, the only person at that table, the only Asian, the only minority, and you will begin to lose that self-consciousness. But sometimes I think for women, for my daughters, for girls, that sometimes the greatest barrier is our own mind. It's our own head about what it is we think makes us stand out or makes us self-conscious. I know that if I see something different, I give it about 3 seconds of thought, and then I forget about it, and we're in the business of what we're supposed to accomplish.
Who is it, Catherine, if I may ask you, that's putting it in the girls' heads that they have limitations on them because of their gender?
Well, I think they want the boys to like them, and they think that if they're more passive, that the boys will think they're more attractive. And so they don't speak up.
Yeah, interesting. Mm-hmm. Chief, when you were growing up, was there anyone when you decided to go into the law, was there anyone who said, well, you know, why don't you maybe, you know, you should be a legal secretary or any, you know, which is what, maybe that was an earlier generation of women who were in the law, I don't know. But were there people who, you know, sort of tried to lower your expectations?
Well, certainly. There were family members who didn't want me to get hurt and wanted me to take a safer route and who wondered how I could perform as a lawyer. But I took their advice as caring for me, but sort of misguided, that, you know, you want to take chances because you don't want to live with professional regrets. And so I tell my girls, Catherine, when they talk or when I see certain behavior, I explain to them that in time, well, especially my daughter in high school, I tell her that this is a transition period and you're supposed to learn a lot of coping skills, and you will learn that what's happening in high school will change. And so I have a sticker on my a magnet on my refrigerator that really talks to them about what they want to be as women, and that this is sort of a training ground for you to become a woman, and that we all need to really sort of drop our self-consciousness and do our best regardless of gender or race or ethnic origin.
How old are your daughters?
15 and 12. Okay. They're that age, Catherine, where they are concerned about what the boys think.
And how do they feel about their mom being Chief Justice? Do they? Your older daughter, I'm sure, gets what that means, but does the younger one?
They probably get what it means, but it matters little to them.
Yeah.
I think they're very healthy teenagers because they're very egocentric.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. And Gregory in Woodside, welcome.
Good morning. I wanted to ask what kind of mechanism there is within the system to sort of weed out judges that may be like racially deciding cases or have prejudices against people of certain minority groups. Yeah, I have my own personal story, but generally I just wanted to find out what kind of mechanism is there to, you know, say, oh, you know, if you happen to be an African-American in front of this judge, you're 100 times more likely to end up behind bars than getting a fine.
Well, Gregory, I'm sorry to hear you've had that experience, and I think there are definitely mechanisms. And when you feel that, I think the first probably notice or letter ought to be to the judge. Also, that judge likely has a presiding judge who runs the court itself. And if you feel strongly and have the concerns that this is an ongoing issue or is an issue at all, we also have what we call the Commission on Judicial Performance, which is a constitutional body that oversees, regulates, and disciplines judges who violate the canons or the code of ethics. All judges have codes of ethics that we are required to follow and comport with, not only on the bench, but off the bench as well.
Does that respond to your question, Gregory?
Sure, but I was wondering if internally, you know, do you have, like, red flags that kind of go up where you watch, you know, statistics, about the, you know, the cases and, you know.
How often do judges get disciplined?
Judges are not often disciplined, but there's an investigation that goes on to determine whether there are grounds to do that. And we have an active Commission on Judicial Performance. The commission is composed of lawyers and also public citizens. But in terms of your question, Gregory, do I see red flags? Do I see things along those lines? You know, I can't speak specifically to anything like that that shows up with any kind of recurring regularity. That's something that, you know, when we look at hundreds of cases, it doesn't necessarily permit us with 1,700 judges in the state making countless decisions that we would be able, at least at the Supreme Court level, to be able to know that.
All right, Gregory, thanks for the call. I want to ask you a question about the budget. Of course, they're still trying to come to an agreement on the budget up in Sacramento, but I believe the governor's budget has the courts slated for about a $200 million budget cut. What would that mean to the courts?
That is a very alarming, serious budget cut. It means quite a bit to the court because we are looking at it not only for fiscal year 11-12, we have to look at it in terms of the cumulative cuts that the branch has sustained since 08-09. And since 08-09, we have sustained up till current year $285 million in cuts to our budget. Now, keep in mind that the judicial branch budget of the pie of the general state fund budget is only 3.1%. So we take this $200 million cut in fiscal year 11-12. Well, in year 10-11, just for example, the current year we're in, we took a $130 million reduction. So this $200 million reduction in 11-12 compounds that. That's a reduction that occurs across the board. Now, that is alarming to us because while we are sustaining and trying to meet these reductions, we've also had caseload growth. We've also suffered from the insufficient number of judges to address caseload growth. And so we are really sort of moving on in a very uncomfortable, almost impossible situation with these cuts, caseload growth, need for judges. And so we have really worked hard this fiscal year in anticipation of next fiscal year with a budget working group that I put together that would try to offset that $200 million reduction in such a way that it doesn't fall so hard on the trial courts and the state courts.
How do you do that? Like, where do you trim $200 million without having, you know, courtrooms closed one day a week or something, reduced hours, that kind of thing?
Well, what we've done is we've looked at certain funds that the judicial branch maintains primarily for construction or modernization or education or for computers, and we have taken and shaved off and done some one-time fund transfers to offset the $200 million reduction such that the $176.8 million that's supposed to fall on the trial courts isn't so much on the trial courts. And these one-time fund transfers to alleviate the reduction, although some reduction will still fall on the trial courts, puts us in a very precarious position next year because it reduces our funds.
What did the governor say? I mean, you certainly made those points to him, I'm sure, in your meeting a few weeks ago.
That's correct.
Is he sympathetic?
The governor, of course, is sympathetic, but the state as a whole faces a greater issue across the board. And so we realize that there are cuts made to every single entity, and this is our share. And so while he's sympathetic, he has to balance that and has and told me that he has to balance it with other cuts, and we understand that.
How there isn't really a constituency for the courts in the way that there is for, say, the disabled or low-income folks or children, for example. I mean, does that put you sort of behind the eight ball a little bit?
I think it does, because it's true, and I have said this before, when I go to the Capitol, I go with great folks from the Judicial Council, great judges and folks from the bench bar committees, and other PJs, presiding judges of different courts, and we go to the courts, along with the AOC staff, as the judicial branch, we go to the legislature. But what we don't deliver particularly are either A, votes, B, a constituency, or C, any campaign funds. So we have to rely on them understanding that this is a judicial branch and we play an important function.
Part of the issue, too, is that a lot of the budget cuts have been challenged in court. Advocates for one particular funding stream or another will go in, and in many cases, judges have reversed the cuts and said, no, state of California, you can't make this cut.
That's correct. Well, that is the beauty of our three branches of government. We check and balance each other, and that's what the judicial branch does, is uphold the Constitution and the laws.
All right. We're talking to the Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court, Tani Cantil Sacaue. If you want to ask her a question, make a comment, the number 866-733-6786. You can also email your thoughts to forum@kqed.org. Let's go to Mark now in Palo Alto. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Chief. And I just want to say up front that I've actually been an employee of the AOC and work as an analyst since the year 2000. So I just wanted to make sure I kind of state that up front.
And the AOC, we should just say, is the administrative office of the courts.
Right. Thank you. What I wanted to ask is that trial court unification and centralization was kind of going on right when I first came in. And the purpose of it was to ensure that adjudication around the state, no matter which county you went to, there was going to be sufficient resource to ensure that someone got a fair trial and got, you know, the same result that they would in any county around the state. And so the centralization of it seems like it helped towards that. But I know that there is concern now in some counties that they want to see more decentralization. And so I was wondering if you could speak for just a minute or two about trying to find that balance where we make sure that everybody's got the right amount of resources, but also still has kind of enough of a local voice to make things work.
Thank you, Mark. That's a good question. You're right. What we're talking about now in 2011 is balance. We have seen a tremendous amount of growth in the structure and strength of the branch in the last 14 years with, as you've just described, trial court funding, state trial court funding in 1997, which gave us the, instead of the counties funding the trial courts, the state took over funding of the trial courts. Along with a year thereafter came the unification of the trial courts. That is, it went from a 220-court system to a 58-court system. And with that came a better use of resources, because in those days, I used to be in the Muni Court, and there was a Superior Court. And therefore, we had two clerks of the court, two offices of HR, two offices, period, for every function that the Muni Court performed and the Superior Court performed. So when those two Muni and Superior Courts were unified, we were able to eliminate one office, merge the two, and create one office. So there was tremendous efficiency. Thereafter came, as we've talked about in terms of funding, the state court construction, where the facilities of the courts were turned over to the judicial branch. So you're right, there was great growth, and there is now a need for balance. And so I am looking to the best possible balance of resources in the AOC, the judicial branch. And we're looking at that through ways of hearing. I personally want to hear from the trial courts what it is specifically they want, what they are most concerned about with decentralization. Now, I've heard, actually, Mark, concepts, but what I'd like to actually hear and see, and I hope to meet with the presiding judges and the judges, is to find out specifically, if you could give me an example of where it is you think that the system needs repair, that we can look at doing that together.
Well, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Well, one of the criticisms that they have is the centralized computer system, which was used, I think, as part of this unification of the courts. And there was an audit recently, as I'm sure you know, that the costs for that computer have ballooned from, I think, $260 million to $1.9 billion. Is that a – seems like that would be a legitimate concern, and I know that's one of the things some of these judges have complained about. Do you think there's something else going on? It sounds like you say maybe there is.
Well, first let me address CCMS. It's true, but we're talking about estimated costs. We're talking about estimated costs of deployment. So when people say $260 million to $1.9 billion, that's talking as if the CCMS computer program has been deployed to every 58 court in the state, which is not where we are currently. And so what we're talking about is a program that has is an almost a software program that's almost finished that the courts may use instead of their antiquated system now or systems that are breaking down now, because the 58 courts use many, what I've heard is over 200 different court computer programs. And those don't belong to the court and they're all different. And so the courts need to be certainly have very, well, what I think is excellent communication backbone, and they need to have a system that speaks and works for them. And like other states, especially all other states on the West Coast, they have centralized case management systems so that one county can speak to another county, so that you can see that a defendant who lives in Petaluma has a case in San Diego, and that you can see what's going on with that person when you craft orders. So in terms of CCMS, no one disagrees with the vision of it and its product. The argument and the issues have been with its development and its costs. And to that end, the Judicial Council and AOC have adopted every single recommendation by the auditor, and we're looking to see how that goes from here. But there is, I understand, to be additional concern that goes to centralization versus decentralization with whether or not there is sufficient representation on Judicial Council of the courts and whether the courts have enough say in policymaking. And I'm taking a very close look at that.
And I think you've talked about expanding that body so that there will be more, perhaps more seats. Am I mixing apples and oranges here? But I saw you sent out a video message to the courts, mm-hmm. I think just last week perhaps.
That's right.
And you want to expand that the group of voting members, is it, with the Judicial Council, so that perhaps some of these voices are included, or am I misinterpreting that?
No, I want to clarify, you're accurate in the sense that I want to broaden the membership of Judicial Council. But I need to look at several things with Judicial Council, and I have several ideas about how to do that, but I would like to hear from others how they would like to see Judicial Council expanded. I'd also like to see more involvement of new judges or newer judges or new to it governance come in and participate in the advisory committees. The advisory committees do a tremendous amount of valuable work for the branch. They actually formulate the proposals that turn into policy. And those advisory committees are made up of volunteer judges and lawyers and other stakeholders who bring their expertise. So the issues that come to Judicial Council are not brand new. They are matters that have been worked on by committees that come up and are vetted up to Judicial Council. And so we need more voices in that process. We also need potentially more membership on the Judicial Council.
All right, let's go to some email now. Mike writes, when a Republican governor started appointing judges 25 to 30 years ago to the California Supreme Court, landmark cases supporting plaintiffs in personal injury suits were depublished to the benefit of insurance companies. In Bush v. Gore, the U.S. Supreme Court voted strictly along ideological lines, with Republican appointees voting for Bush, Democrats for Gore. Don't these instances suggest political or economic bias in the court?
Well, I can't speak to the court 25 years ago, and I can't speak to the federal court. I can only speak to the experience I have had in 20 years and my 30, well, not quite 30, maybe 90, almost 90 days on the California Supreme Court. And to me, judges are vetted before they come to either the trial court as an appointee or to the Court of Appeal as a justice or to the Supreme Court. And that vetting is conducted by the state bar, and it is far and wide, and it is also confidential, so that when people write in to vet or evaluate a judge candidate or a justice candidate, it's anonymous. So if there is political bias or has been political bias in that applicant's prior experience or as a judge or as a lawyer, that would come to bear, that would be known. And so there is a process for weeding that out. I can't speak to 25 years ago. The process has changed so radically from 25 years ago, and nor can I speak to the federal court.
There is a perception, though, widely held perception, that at the U.S. Supreme Court, that it is very ideological. And I'm wondering if you think even the perception of that is troubling at all.
I think the perception is always troubling. I think the perception is something that probably, unfortunately, supplants reality. But again, the federal system is quite different. The federal system process is quite different. And then those are life appointments, which are quite different.
Yeah. You are a registered Republican, I believe. You work for Governor Duke Majan. I'm just curious how you came to be a Republican. What was it that attracted you to the party?
Well, in 1980, I was – maybe 1979, I was a senior about to graduate from UC Davis, and I received an opportunity to work for then-Senator Jim Nielsen in the Capitol. And that he wanted, you know, in order to work for him in those days, you needed to be registered, and the young Republicans would prefer a Republican – intern. And at that point in 1979, I was not declared. I think I was barely 18. And so I wanted to work for Senator Nielsen. I saw his record. I thought that he was a law and order man. And therefore, I wanted to work for him in my last year in college. So I signed up to be a Republican. And then I was about to apply to Senator Nielsen's office. And then I found out, lo and behold, I had enough credits and I was going to be out of school in the summer of 1980 because I was graduating. And I graduated in the summer of 1980, never having actually worked for Senator Nielsen. That being the case, I was a registered Republican, and shortly thereafter, when I went into law school and came out and George Duke Majan was governor, I, of course, my ideals of law and order resonated with George Duke Majan, and I've stayed a Republican ever since.
And you were a deputy district attorney, I think, in Sacramento before you worked for him, and you're married to a police lieutenant from the Sacramento Police Department.
That's right.
I wonder, you know, there are some people who feel that the Republican Party has become too exclusive, that it has espoused ideas around things like immigration and perhaps gay marriage, gay rights, that make people feel unwelcome in the party. Does that concern you at all?
Well, I read that in the paper, but sort of I hearken back to an earlier answer. We know judges, we read the paper and we're aware of the issues, but we don't delve into them the way we delve in those political issues. We don't delve into those the way we delve into the facts of a case or prior case law and how it's evolved. We don't delve into the meaning of those political stories the way we delve into the Constitution and what it means today. So I understand those stories are out there, but I feel ill-equipped to actually comment with any kind of authority on them.
But even as a person, not as a judge?
As a person, what do I think about the stories?
No. I mean, does it concern you at all that the party that you signed up with, has in the minds of some drifted too far to the right?
Certainly. You know, as a person, my whole thought is that the media, the reporting sort of indicates that Republicans have drifted to the right, that there may be no real moderate, no real centrists anymore. And that concerns me as a person.
Yeah. All right. I think we have a call here. Let's go to Annette in Palo Alto. Welcome to the program, Annette.
Thank you. And Madam Chief Justice, thank you very much for coming on the program.
My pleasure.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that you've observed that judges do not allow personal or political views to influence their decisions. And I wanted to know, if I understood that correctly, how do you then explain the fact that judges do develop a reputation for voting liberal, conservative, prejudiced, or progressive, and so on?
I'm not sure I understand your question, that judges vote their...
Yes, when they come to vote on a decision.
That they have a reputation as being a liberal judge,
right,
or a conservative judge.
Right, that they still develop a reputation for being in a certain camp.
Well, I have to say I don't really particularly judge a decision in and of itself in terms of when you say a reputation for voting. I guess I'd have to know the entire judge's I suppose, portfolio of decisions, and then be able to make an analysis and say, yes, they have this reputation because they always do this or they always do that. And I don't know that's the case, because cases are complicated and cases have facts that are not always reported to the media, that come by way of transcript and the trial and the briefs. So a lot of matters are taken into consideration, even though what's reported is the final decision and maybe even the case itself, the published case. What people don't see are the briefing, are the arguments, are the transcripts, the evidence, and the record that goes into what eventually is this opinion that might be anywhere from 1 to 200 pages long. So I don't believe in, you know, myself, I don't really believe in quote-unquote reputations. So that's my view, and that's been my experience.
All right, Annette, thanks for the call. We're almost at the end of the hour, Chief, but I wanted to talk with you quickly about technology. I know you're a big texter, aren't you? I've heard that you're known to send emails and texts, and that's a big change for the court from your predecessor.
Yes, it is. Apparently it is. I'm learning that it is. And I'm not a big texter, except that I know how to communicate with my children, and how I communicate the fastest is through text and email. And most adults over 50 don't text, except now they are learning to text, at least those around me.
You're barely over 50.
Barely, but still. And yes, I think that we can make tremendous use of electronic communications to make us more efficient.
Where do you think it's going in terms of the courts?
I think it will be going in that direction. I think it's going slowly. We still have a lot of learning to do about how to do it best and how to do it, and especially how to do it over confidential matters. But I think overall it will benefit the courts.
All right. Tani Cantil Sacaue, the Chief Justice of California's Supreme Court, thanks so much for being here this morning.
Thank you, Scott. It's been a pleasure.
Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Christina Russo. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Our engineer today is Danny Bringer. I'm Scott Schaefer, here for Michael Krasny. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.